So I think it's just turned 10 o'clock. So let's begin. So please just get comfortable in your seat. Let your shoulders relax and have your back straight. Let your head rest easily on your neck. And you can close your eyes or keep them open. And when you feel comfortable, just let your body breathe itself and relax into the awareness. And imagine that the space around you is completely pure. The ground is made of blue lapis lazuli. It's crisscrossed with gold lines, reflect with gold. The space around you is full of rainbow lights, and there are offerings falling through space. You can see a throne in front of you, and it has cushions of the sun and moon sitting on a lotus. And on the moon disc is Lama Tsongkhapa. He's surrounded by all the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And you see within that vast field of refuge beings, your own teacher. You can also imagine that in this refuge field, there's His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and all the other teachers you have respect for. Then you think that you're really lucky, fortunate to still be alive today and to have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. But you need to act now. Things do not exist as they seem to. And though things are not quite right, we do have a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity, holding a Vajra bell. Decide to make this offering of your practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then from the heart of each being within the refuge field, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and to all the beings surrounding you. All of your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and Dharma realizations. So, cleansed by the power and the love of these enlightened beings, you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. You decide to develop these thoughts yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. And you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and the hatred for enemies. And again, from each of the enlightened beings within the refuge field, in the heart of each, lights and nectar stream down and dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are washed away. Your good health and lifespan are increased. And your virtues and Dharma realizations are similarly increased. Now, wishing to purify any remnants of suffering and to increase the potential for becoming fully enlightened, we call upon the merit field and they appear. And we say in front of them, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent clinging at the practice that we've done so far, we imagine that our body takes on the form of a universe, and we offer this to the merit field. We say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. The Buddha accepts this offering and he smiles at us with delight. And we look up into his eyes and we meet his gaze. And in the eyes of the Buddha we find immense humility and kindness. And from this field for accumulating merit, our own root guru, the teacher we feel most affection for and appreciate the most, leaves that field, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. And he makes three requests to the field for accumulating merit. He requests that inspiring blessings pour down upon yourself and all beings surrounding you, so that all perverse minds are quickly stopped, that the generation of pure minds begins immediately, and all outer, inner, and secret obstructions come to an end. In response to his prayer, from the heart of each holy being, lights and nectar stream down, and these purify the mind and grant the blessings. And from the state of purification and blessing, you recollect the three principal aspects of the path. You decide to abandon engaging with the causes of suffering. You wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. And you want to adopt the correct view that all phenomena which dependently arise are empty of any intrinsic nature. from the heart of Lama Sol Kapa appearing as the Buddha. Infinite life rays spread out, filling the 10 directions of space. And everything dissolves into light. And this dissolves into the Guru. So Lama Tsongkhapa, who's an essence of the Buddha, moves through space now and comes to abide and rest into the emanation of your Guru at your crown. So now your teacher, Buddha Shakyamuni, and Lama Tsongkhapa are one single entity. This entity becomes very small and begins to descend, entering the crown of your head, come down through your body to rest at your heart. Then your mind, the mind of the Buddha, the mind of Lama Tsongkhapa, the mind of your own Guru, become one essence. Mantras of all the Buddhas are heard within you. And whatever mantra you're familiar with, you can recite now. Now from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into a fully awakened state. From the 10 directions of space, as light begins to withdraw and re-enters your body at the level of your heart, you become aware of your breath and the seat you're sitting upon. So you feel embodied. You realize that this meditation was one of imagination. Nevertheless, it has imprinted your mind with this potential for full awakening. By relying upon an authentic spiritual teacher and his authentic path, you know you can become enlightened because none of the obscurations intrinsically exist. They are all adventitious. And if you put into effort this path, you can awaken for the benefit of others. The thing is, for that purpose that you're studying the special insight section on the Lam Rim Chenma. And you're breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes open in your own time. And move yourself around till you feel quite comfortable. Okay, so let's have a look at what we're doing today. So in the actual text is this day 15, so I've broken it up into two parts again. So I've got 13 questions this week and there'll be 10 in the next fortnight. So what we're covering three things. One's called the objects of negation. The other is the qualifications of the object of negation. And lastly, criteria for conventional existence. So the objects of negation for the middle way consequence school is intrinsic nature or inherent existence. And Chandrakirti describes it like this. What exists objectively by its own essence without being posited by mind? This is called self or intrinsic nature. And this is the object to be negated from the point of view of the middle way consequence. So this lack of self, or this lack of intrinsic existence, is realized through reasoning. When we see that, we see directly the phenomena lack the intrinsic nature they seem to have, we have this direct perception of selflessness or emptiness. And this really stops the deluded way we have of seeing objects exist inherently. In terms of the criteria for conventional existence, here we see the differences between the middle way consequence school and the schools below them, in particular the middle way autonomy. So they're also saying, we agree that things do not exist intrinsically, ultimately. So they use the term ultimate. They put that always there. Because they say, actually, they do exist intrinsically, conventionally. We're sort of going through these three topics today. In terms of the objects of negation, there are sort of divisions made. So there's some questions asked about these divisions. So the questions are, how are the objects to be negated classified? So Bruce, would you like to do that one first?
So I've got divided into the objects negated by reason and objects negated by logic.
Okay, so you've got reason, and which is like reason is the logic part, Bruce, and the other, or you've got reason and basically path.
And then there's
a sort of side question asking about what are the objects negated by the path and what are the objects negated by reason. So in terms of the path, there are the objects or the obstructions to liberation and the obstructions to Buddhahood. And those that are negated by reason, inherent existence, and the subject, meaning the consciousness that apprehends them. So in the ones negated by reason, there are some things that do exist and some things that don't exist. So the inherent existence does not exist, but the consciousness apprehending it does exist. The next question asks, in relation to how a sprout exists, what is the object to be negated and what is the subject to be negated? So Linda, would you like to have a go at that one?
Sorry, press the wrong button. So the object to be negated is that the sprout exists inherently.
Excellent, yep.
And the subject to be negated is the grasping that holds the sprout to be inherently existing or truly existing.
Excellent. That's right. That's right. So in other words, yeah, it's basically that straightforward. Is this sort of clear to everybody, or is there this explanation's good for everyone? It's a bit like the story about when you see a mirage in the desert. So the object to be negated is like the mirage in the desert. When the mirage vanishes, you don't see the mirage anymore. It can't appear to your mind. So if you get rid of one, the other will fall away, in other words. Next question is, which is the primary? Is it the subject to be negated or the object to be negated? Delma, would you like to answer this one?
Inherent existence.
Okay, inherent existence, and that is the, is it the object or the subject? It's the object, isn't it? That's right. So it's the object communicated, the inherent existence of the sprout, in this case, in this example. So why is that? Why is it the object can be negated the most important between these two?
Because it's what needs to be negated.
And why is that though, Bruce?
Is it that it's what appears to the mind, Eddie?
Did you say a bit more about that, Chris?
If it's the object to be negated, it's the object that appears to the mind.
Yes, and
sorry, that's all I got.
Anyone else like to have a shot at this?
Yeah, I'll have a go.
Yeah.
I put that we need to understand how grasping at the at true existence or inherent existence is inaccurate. And think about how things dependently exist so that we can then develop doubt about whether or not our current view is correct.
Okay, so it's if you negate the object, the subject can't arise. It's as simple as that. It's like the idea of if there is no mirage, you won't see a mirage. Right? So if there's no inherent existence, you don't see inherent existence. It can't appear to you. That's it. Simply put, it can't appear to your mind. If the object's gone, yeah, the subject and object exist interdependently, don't they? If one goes, the other has to go too. Does this make sense to you? You understand? If you take one thing away, which is an inherent existence, then you can't perceive it. That's why you do that one first. I guess this sort of comes to this next one. So why is the object primary? Chris, why is the object primary?
Because it's the essence for realizing emptiness, and then thereby you avoid the extremes of being overly broad or overly restricted.
Yeah, so if you refute the object, this eliminates the subject. The basis for that grasping has to drop because there's no object there to be grasped at. Simply put, this is how it works, right? So imagine, right? You imagine. So first of all, it's appearing to you, isn't it? Inherent existence. You've got the sprout and the inherent existence of the sprout. They're one and the same thing. You examine to see, does the sprout actually have inherent existence? You find it doesn't. So the mind can't it can't apprehend it, right? That's the point. When you see the object has no inherent existence, the subject cannot hold on to, can't grasp at inherent existence, because there is none there.
So Eddie, that means that You see the sprout, but the sprout no longer appears to be inherently existing. It appears to be dependently arising. Is that what you mean by that?
That'll come up like after, right? But in the meditative experience of this, the sprout disappears, and so there's no inherent existence there. When you come out of it, you'll know it has no inherent existence. It dependently exists. So while you're in the meditation, right, you're examining to see whether this sprout has the inherent existence it seems to have. That's the object, right? The inherent existence of the sprout. When it's seen to not be there, the seer, the subject, the mind, has no inherent existence, right? That can't appear to it. Like I say, it's, if you use something else to do this, Kintsa Rinpoche said always, use examples, similes, metaphors, use real examples, because it really helps, because you're really grounded in something. So like I said again, like, you know, if you go out there in the world and you look and you see across, yeah, sometimes when you go on those long rides and you look right in the distance and it looks like there's water on the road. Well, that's a mirage, isn't it? There's no water on the road, but it looks like there is. Yeah? Now, if you keep driving towards it, the water will disappear, won't it? The appearance of water, the mirage will vanish. When that happens, does your mind keep on seeing water on the road? No, it doesn't. That's what they're pointing out here. That's why the object is so important. When the object vanishes, it vanishes from your mind too. That's what it's really trying to get at here. That's why he's saying, look, it's really important to get rid of the object, and the subject can't hold it. Otherwise, it'd be quite difficult, wouldn't it? Because it's still appearing there. And what are you telling yourself? Oh, it's not there. It's not there. Yeah. Which is what you do later on, isn't it? Coming out of it, because you realize, oh my gosh, it still appears to be there, but I know it's not there. That's why we say things appear like a mirage, like an illusion. You know, just sort of think about it. You get it.
My AI came up with a different metaphor, Eddie.
Okay, what was your one, Sue? What did it say?
It says, negating inherent existence is like removing a shadow from extinguishing a shadow by extinguishing its source of light. Without the source, the shadow naturally disappears.
And the source here is the light.
That's right. So you get, you're trying to...
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Yeah. So with the light, the shadow appears. You pull away the light, there's no shadow.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Eddie, I'm looking at a beautiful tree. It appears to be over there. It appears to be dependent and appears to be separate.
Yeah.
If I then have the realization of this, will I then just... What will happen actually to that tree in terms of, from my mind? I would no longer grasp at it inherently.
The tree will not be there. The tree will not be there.
In terms of
your experience of meditative equipoise, the tree will not be there.
Okay.
So if there's no tree there, you can't see a tree, can you?
Correct.
No. So if there's no inherent existence there, you can't see inherent existence there, can you?
Yes, but the dependently arising tree will be there.
But you're not going to see that when you're in meditative equipoise. You're seeing a dependently arising tree that's inherently existent.
Right. Okay. So you have to be in equipoise. Okay.
Yeah. So we're talking here about meditative equipoise.
Thank you.
It was when you come out of course, then you get the dependent arising that's right there, but you know... This object, this dependently arisen tree, is without the intrinsic nature it appeared to have. That's discovered in meditative equipoise. So using this example of tree is a good one, actually, Chris. Yeah, like if you pull the tree down, there's no tree. You don't see a tree. If you remove inherent existence, which is your object, you can't see inherent existence. It's not there. It's never been there. So this is why the important thing is the object. You've got to get the object.
So as ordinary beings walking along on our daily walk, seeing a tree and examining it and trying to concentrate solely on the tree and breaking it down.
Yeah.
You still need to be sort of sitting on your mat, I take it, to actually do this.
No, you're right, though. You can do this walking around, right? But what you get then is a correct conceptual understanding that tree hasn't any inherent existence.
But you have to be in meditation.
To have if you want to get the perceptual thing of it, and when you're in perceptual, the tree is going to vanish completely. There's going to be no tree there, and there's going to be no inherently existent tree there either. So if we were walking about doing this analysis, in the world with our eyes wide open and just looking at that tree. Once you start like breaking it down, the phenomena called tree is going to vanish, isn't it? What you're going to end up with, first of all, branch. Then you're going to go with like part of a branch. Then you start knocking that down, then you're going to get into atomic nature. It's going to get smaller and smaller, but the idea of a tree is falling away. So, that's in your mental work, right? Because with your eyes open, the tree's got to stay right there, isn't it? Even though you're still talking about breaking it down into parts and so forth. Yeah. Okay, well, I hope this will become more clearer to you, which is interesting because now we have this importance of the clear identity. So why is it so important to clearly identify what is to be negated? So Chris, your last answer had to do a bit with this, Chris Lumley. So anybody else, why is it so important to clearly identify what's to be negated? There's a number of answers you can give here that were in the text. So anybody would like to throw out an answer?
Because one answer is not being either too broad or too narrow.
Yep, this is right. Yep.
So that you don't fall into nihilism or eternalism.
Yep, this is right. Yeah, so so I drew my answer from that. So the extremes are nihilism and eternalism, and we wish to avoid those two extremes. What we're really after is inherent existence. Right, so you'll know that other schools, this is not their object to be negated. They leave inherent existence alone. All the other schools are saying, look, if phenomena did not have inherent existence, they would not exist at all. And so the middle way consequence is going, so they would say, well, you guys are extreme in one way. And that would probably be the extreme of reification, the extreme of absolutism. You can also say it's really important to clearly identify the object to be negated to free yourself from cyclic existence, because that's what it really, if you do that, the other thing follows. And you can't free yourself from cyclic existence unless you identify this object and negate it. You might also say it's the deepest form of ignorance that we have, so you need to be able to identify it and negate it. So, anything interesting in this? It's this little bit we've just gone through. Anything you'd like to ask about or venture forward?
Well, just in relation to that last question, in Kensa Rinpoche's commentary, he did talk about it all starts with identifying the object to be negated, because that allows you to release your grasping at those objects, which means you can also address the disturbing emotions that are associated with that grasping.
Yeah, grasping, that's right, Bruce. Yeah, this is right. Yeah, so like I said, there's quite a number of different answers you could give here. So one of the things I have with it, we want to isolate inherent existence, which, this is why we want to identify this object, inherent existence, without undermining dependent origination. So we find this middle way. We're not negating the objects, we're just negating the inherent existence of them, where they seem to exist. What might happen if, for instance, we didn't clearly identify this object?
We head south instead of north.
Yeah. And what's south, Sue?
the lower realm.
Well, yeah, it's cyclic existence.
Cyclic. Yeah.
If you go south, you're in the wrong direction. You probably negate too much, or you don't negate enough. So you reify everything, which is probably better in a way, or else you negate everything. So you negate everything, of course, and you go up cause and effect, and like Sue says, it's the lower realms. At least if you reify, you might end up in the higher realms. But either way, you stay in cyclic existence. Okay, let's do a meditation then. So again, just get comfortable in your seat. Drop your shoulders, straighten your back, place your hands wherever you like. And if you like, you can close your eyes or keep them partially open. Let your body settle and breathe itself. Generate an altruistic aspiration. Whereby we were seeking to discover the truth of reality, not just for ourselves, but for the sake of all beings. We wish to free ourselves from all the misconceptions that keep us in cyclic existence, share our knowledge with others, and encourage them to do just the same as we have done, to abandon the two obscurations. These two obscurations are rooted in the belief of inherent existence. The belief that things exist without dependence. So what is inherent existence? So simply, it's a belief that things exist without any dependence upon the mind. That the phenomena exist independently, not dependent upon things like causes, conditions, their parts, but most important, mind and language. And we cling to this habit in the same way that we might mistake a rope for a snake in the darkness. So what replaces our inherent existence? When we see the phenomena lack inherent existence, we understand that they dependently arise. The phenomena existing through causes, conditions, and labels. So you can imagine that all of our reasoning up to now has created a tree of misconceptions. But right now its roots of inherent existence can be severed by the middle way reasoning. So how does middle way reasoning free the mind from the grasping at inherent existence? What dissolves the rigid extremes of nihilism and absolutism. Wisdom arises as an alternative, a middle way. So emptiness and interdependence become clear, like sunlight illuminating that rope, and we see there is no snake there. that sort of reflect that all your experiences are dependently arisen. We all have assumptions about how things exist and what took place, but we need to challenge these with our understanding of dependent arising and being empty. Everything that seems solid and real is in fact a sort of dance of causes, conditions, and luminous potential. We try to use our understanding to navigate the illusions of true existence that life throws at us. And then breathing in deeply through your nostrils, just exhale. Okay, so we've got a little bit of time. So we'll go through this next section and then we'll have a break. So this has to do about these qualifications. So having identified the object to be negated, the text then discuss the qualifications and two objects of negation. So what's the relevance of this discussion? Anybody like to volunteer an answer? This one is not so easy to find this actually, you know, to draw it out.
I had the qualifications refine the scope of a negation.
Yes, they do.
Like,
yep,
yeah, adding qualifications to objects of negation is like using a magnifying glass to focus sunlight, ensures precision without burning the unintended areas.
Nice one. Okay, so anyone else?
Eddie, this was just my almost layman's attempt at it, was to enhance further the standard, provide insight as to when a certain criteria is relevant, and form the basis when engaged in debate.
Okay. Could you just say it again, please, Chris?
Yeah, so I said these qualifications to the objects of negation are to enhance further understanding, provide insight as to when certain criteria is relevant, and then form the basis when engaged in debate.
So in essence, what's trying to go on here, this idea of a precise negation. Remember here, the precise negation is inherent existence, and it's the object communicated by the middle way consequence. No other school does this. They leave inherent existence alone. They leave it alone because they say if things don't inherently exist, they don't exist at all. The middle way consequence don't take that position. They say actually by undermining inherent existence, we leave conventional existence alone. It actually illuminates conventional existence to be without inherent existence and to depend upon causes, conditions, parts, and labeling. One of the things it said here, the discussion on qualifications to objects of negation is crucial for precise philosophical analysis in middle way Buddhism. It clarifies when to add qualifiers like inherently or ultimately when refuting existence. This precision helps avoid overly broad or narrow negations, ensuring an accurate understanding of emptiness. So the relevance lies in distinguishing between conventional and ultimate existence. By knowing when to add qualifications, practitioners can refute inherent existence without denying conventional reality. And this nuanced approach preserves the middle way between extremes of existence and non-existence. In terms of metaphor, it says adding qualifications is like using a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer. It allows for surgical precision in refuting misconceptions without destroying valid conventional truths. We're going to have a look at now some of these qualifications. And the first question, question seven is, what qualification is used by the middle way autonomists and other essentialists? So this is not a difficult one because it was right there in the text. So Linda, would you like to throw out an answer on this one?
Yeah, so they say that things exist inherently, but they do not ultimately exist inherently.
Right, that's the first one, isn't it? They don't ultimately exist. The middle way autonomy is big on using this term ultimately. But then there's this other term for essentialists. Who are the essentialists? Who are the other essentialists? Anyone?
All the other schools.
Sorry?
All the other schools?
All the other schools, that's right. So, and the first of these other schools is, of course, the mind only. So they're saying the mind truly exists, inherently exists. So they use this term truly a lot. So I think mind truly exists. And if you look at this, the other, even the Vaibhashika and the Sautrantika are also essentialists. But they grasp that all phenomena having a substantial existence, being self-sufficiently. And the only thing that doesn't is the self of persons, but everything else does. So they're also essentialists. Then there's another school that came along. You might not be familiar with them, but there's a philosophy called the Jonang philosophy. So they use this term like in reality, truly, ultimately. They use all these terms. So later on you might come across a phenomena called a school that goes, there is a self-empty and what's the other empty?
Other.
Other empty, thank you. So it's all about other empty and self-empty. And they are also essentialists. Like they have this argument, they put forward the argument that Buddha nature essentially exists. That's the real thing. So they're looking, and the major difference here is, as you're probably aware, is, so in other words, some schools are looking at Buddha nature through the lens of a conventional truth, and others through ultimate truth. So the middle way concept is called Buddha nature's emptiness, the emptiness of an afflicted mind. What's the empty? That's an ultimate truth. These other guys are saying it's a conventional truth that really exists. So they're essentials. But just like Sue said, the simplest way of going at this is going, any school beneath the middle way consequence is an essentialist. Because they're holding to inherent existence. That's probably, I think that's the simplest way of putting it.
Eddie, may I ask a question? So within Buddhism, there's sort of four schools, the Nyingma, Kagyu, Shakya, and the Gelug. Are all of them middle way consequence in terms of their approach to this?
Yep, they are. They would all say the highest view, the most subtle view of all is the middle way consequence view. Yep, Chris, they do. They have different ways of explaining it. So Lama Tsongkhapa's is quite, to those other schools, I think it's quite radical the way he does it. And Lama Tsongkhapa's like the object's the most important thing. These other schools go mostly, they do object, but mostly subject. So that's where this has this major difference of the texts and explanations and so forth. So you remember, I might have told you about, what's her name? Who was the English nun, the name of the English nun at that 13-year retreat?
Tenzin Palmo? No.
That's right, yeah, Tenzin Palmo. Right? So when she, she had a connection with her Lama, and he asked her, what do you find easier to discover the emptiness of? Like, would it be like a chair or your mind? So she said, mind, my mind. She said, right, you stay with us. And if she said chair, he would have sent her down the road to the Gallupet thing, right? So I looked at her and I said, oh, there's an interesting thing. So one's going for subject and the other's going for object. I mean, they're both objects in a way, aren't they? But one is looking at, you know, the subjective awareness is easier. It's easier. It's like, you know, straight off you go, mind, like, what is that? Where is that? It has no intrinsic nature straight off the bat. Right? So she said, that's easy. That's easy for me. But if she said, like I said, like Chris, you know, you go the other object, the chairs, the trees, you should go do Galupa. Go with the object. So anyway, that was just, I thought that was always interesting to me. It was helped me later on understand the two truths. So the other schools, Chris, major coming from the two truths from the subjective point of view, the other soul kappa comes from the objective point of view. So again, you have some little argy-bargy there too. Okay, now our next question is, give three instances of when you do not need to qualify a statement that something does not exist with the term inherently. Bruce, would you like to have a shot at this?
Yeah, the first one would be when something, things don't exist even conventionally.
Yeah, they don't. For example,
yeah,
a rabbit with horns, right? Next one.
Then, in relation to consideration of time and place. And
yep. So give me an example of time and place then.
Well, Kenzo Rinpoche talked about snow mountains at CI.
That's right. So here's a picture of CI. There's no
snow mountains exist, but not there.
That's right. We don't need to use it here. That's right. Yeah. And the last one?
Is when negating the exaggerations or superimpositions of others, it's not necessary to add the qualification inherently.
That's right. So these are the imaginary constructs, right? They don't exist at all, really. They're a bit like the utter non-existence. They exist only in your imagination. So we don't need to add inherently there. Okay, so when should we add qualifications? Delma, would you like to have a shot at this?
Why not? When you've actually conventionally posited the object.
Okay, for who? Because...
As in which school?
Yeah.
Good question.
Okay, good. Okay, Chris, can you answer this? Good. Thanks, Delma. Good.
So I've got the first part, like Delma says, if you fail to add a qualification when refuting it, then the fallacies you adduce will equally apply to your critique, and hence it will be a sham or a refutation and must be added. I think this sounds like, Eddie, that there was undercurrents, like when we were debating the other schools, that you would be best to add qualifications. So I do think it's for both self and potentially debate, and then maybe other, if you were perhaps given a teaching.
Okay. So it's really important to add qualifications from the middle way autonomous perspective. Because remember, these guys are saying that something does inherently exist and something doesn't. So it's really important then for them to put up, so to let you know, these things inherently exist and these things don't. So you've got, for them, it's really important to put this qualifier up there. But from the middle way consequence point of view, they say there isn't anything that inherently exists, so we don't need to add a qualifier. So what are the phenomena that inherently exist from the autonomous perspective, folks?
Conventional truths?
Yeah, that's right. Conventional truths inherently exist. So then what does not inherently exist for these people?
the self.
So ultimate truths do not ultimately exist from the middle way autonomous perspective and from the middle way consequence perspective. Ultimate truths do not inherently exist. They do not ultimately exist. Conventional truths, from the middle way autonomous perspective, do inherently exist, do ultimately exist. But from the middle way consequence school, they do not inherently exist. In fact, you know, Sue, you were telling me that story about when you were on retreat, and one of the students said, "Oh, the self doesn't exist."
Yeah.
Remember that? And the teacher.
The first retreat.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Right? So that would have been a good time to put a qualifier that there. You're right. The self doesn't ultimately exist.
Yes, she didn't put the qualifier.
No, she didn't put the qualifier
not,
there.
Not so initially.
You can misapprehend that and go, oh, the self doesn't exist conventionally.
Yeah. She qualified at night on the next talk.
Yeah, that's right. It's like she would have thought. That's right. I was a little bit quick there. Yeah. So you'll see, and as you see in the text, there's a the middle way consequence also goes, okay, when I talk with others about this, because I can take it from their perspective as well as my own, I can add qualifiers to make it clearer for them. So why add the qualifiers? I think that little story I just talked to Sue about should demonstrate that. Why add the qualifiers? Linda, I can see you're just about ready to go.
Sorry, wrong button again. Just because it just reduces confusion.
Yeah, that's dead right.
This makes it clear.
Makes it very clear, isn't it? And the confusion arises that if you don't say them, you'll slip off into either nihilism or absolutism. Mm. You'll either, if you don't put them there and the others could very quickly reify phenomena or refute them altogether, move. You know, refute the conventional, like that little story I said with Sue. In Sue's story, a man had a meditative experience, and out of it he came and said, so the self doesn't exist. And the teacher said, first of all, yes. So the teacher would have been thinking, ultimately. But when she said yes, the pupil might have thought conventionally. So this is why it's good to use these qualifications. So we use them to avoid eternalism or nihilism, so to distinguish the conventional from the ultimate. That's why it's useful to use them. And this is why the middle way autonomy are using them.
Eddie, would it also, if you were debating that point, would it also sort of weaken your position if you're a middle way consequence or whatever? It'd weaken your argument.
To use a qualifier?
Okay.
To use a qualifier?
Would it do that?
I don't think so. The way of consequence reasoning, it's not, you know, it would if you were doing autonomous reasoning.
Okay.
Well, they don't do that. They use consequence reasoning. So it's like this is how they don't get trapped like that. They take these other people who use that type of reasoning and show the problems with it. Yeah, so using qualifiers prevents misunderstandings. Okay, so we're after 11. Anyway, let me just do this a little bit, the interesting and the meditation, we'll have a little break. So what is interesting about this for you guys, if anything? Because, you know, sometimes it's so new, isn't it? It's like it's really hard to formulate a question or have a doubt or stuff like that. But that was a good question, Delma. Yeah? This is the sort of stuff to sort of ask. I just say a little bit about this qualification. It said, both schools strategically use qualifiers, meaning inherently produced, this sort of thing, when refuting metaphysical extremes. It prevents misinterpreting emptiness as denying causality. Now, learners must discern when qualifiers clarify versus obscure. So it's difficult and not easy to balance our philosophical rigor with practical applicability. And I think this is the thing, that the example of what happened with in the meditation retreat that Sue just did. But you'll also find this, if you look widely enough, you'll come across people who say, the self does not exist. Like, there's plenty of people that say that, self does not exist. So from a middle way consequence point of view, how might you respond to that? So if you use just consequence itself, right? If you use the consequence, somebody says, the self does not exist. What would be the consequence of that?
Nihilism.
Yeah, but give me an example of that nihilism.
So you don't exist.
That's right. You just go, what did you say? You say, I'm sorry, I don't hear anything. Right? Why? Because you don't exist. It's only because you are speaking to me that I can hear you. Right? So that's the consequence of your non-existence. You wouldn't be able to appear to me. I wouldn't be able to hear you. You are a non-existent. How can you even speak to me? This would be a consequence of I don't exist, wouldn't it? So the thing is, you could, if you wanted to, how about you help that person to go, shit, they'd be confused then, wouldn't they? They'd go, hang on, I just had this reasoning experience or whatever, where I discovered that I did not exist. Now that I'm talking to you, you're right. I do exist, because if I didn't exist, I couldn't even talk to you. So how do you sort of bring those two back together again?
With a qualifier, exist inherently.
Yeah, that's what you say. You do not exist inherently. You do exist conventionally. Conventionally, you're speaking to me. I heard you say, I don't exist inherently. That's the part they're missing. And everybody misses. They don't know. Even I missed it when I was 13, 14. You think, wow, inherent existence is conventional existence. Therefore, I don't exist. But it's not. So this is very, I find this very useful when you, like I said, listen to other Dharma teachers or other students. You can sort of relax, you know. They say, I don't exist. You can go very quickly, inherently. Ultimately, yep, you don't. Conventionally, you do. So from our perspective, we can be wide open and chill out, right? And everybody else can argue as much as they like. It's like, yeah, because you haven't worked out the subtle difference between ultimate and conventional. Anyway, let's just do our last meditation. We'll have a little tea break and we'll come back and finish off the class. So again, we just get comfortable in the seat. Maybe take a deep breath and just exhale. And just let the body soften. And then let the body breathe itself. And notice the rhythm of your breath. And just relax into that aware state. from this balanced perspective, imagine a vast, open, sunlit sky. It's not completely empty, and it's not permanent. It's just open. So the emptiness of mind is like this boundless, open, sunlit sky. The emptiness of this mind is not non-existent, but interdependent. And this knowledge dissolves rigid views. Like a mirror, it reflects without clinging to the appearances. So clinging is an extreme. Why avoid that form of extreme? Because one extreme denies existence and the other extreme reifies existence. So we have non-existence and permanence. So avoiding the extremes brings about a sense of balance. You walk between the two extremes. Walking between the two extremes, we can use the balance pole of qualification. Qualifications clarify different levels of truth. They help distinguish the conventional from inherent. So why might these explanations of ultimate truth and conventional truth differ across the different schools? The explanations are different because they are adaptations to the various needs of students. Some stress conventional reality, others the ultimate truth. The explanations are tailored advice to fit the listener. I'm going to try and carry this clarity, our understandings from this class into the day. Hopefully we can observe appearances without attachment. We can embrace interdependence. We're breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale and let your eyes flutter open. And with your attention back in front of the screen, we'll take a 10-minute break. So these next slides really have to do about conventional existence. So this question is asked, you know, what are the three criteria asserted by middle-way consequentialists for something to conventionally exist? Okay, so Bruce, would you like to give us the first one? What would you probably know all of them, but this could be one.
That they do exist conventionally. So I'm guessing we're thinking about horned rabbits and things like that, but they're not like that.
Yeah, okay, so this, yep, okay. So in other words, you're saying that the criteria will not be contradicted by another conventional valid cognizer. Because that's what you're saying. You're saying, well, hang on, you know, rabbits have horns. And then somebody else goes along and says, gee, Bruce, I don't see any rabbits with horns. So then you say, oh, okay, so rabbits with horns don't exist. So that would sort of illustrate what you just said, right? It's not contradicted by another conventional valid cognizer. So that is one of the ways a phenomenon has to conventionally exist. So Linda, what's another way?
So the first one was the object must not be invalidated by the reasoning that analyzes reality.
Okay, that's right. So what does that mean?
I was going to ask you the same thing.
Well, in brief, it means that when you analyze this object, the reality is it's empty of inherent existence. So when you analyze the conventional phenomena, it cannot have inherent existence.
Okay.
That's what it's saying. It's empty of that. And download this, so there's one more missing. It's the simplest and easiest one. What's the first one?
Thank you for that. It's good to have you. Something that's or that it's known to worldly consciousness.
That's right. Excellent. That's right. So that's the first one, right? So it has to be known to worldly consensus, being a worldly valid condition. The one that Bruce said, it must not be contradicted by another conventional valid condition. And finally, the last one that Linda said, it cannot be invalidated by a reasoning that analyzes reality. Yeah, so conventional existence requires a logical, empirical, and consensual support. So the consensual report's the first one, the empirical is the second, and the logical is the third. It does not require inherent existence. That's what it's sort of getting at. Conventional criteria, conventional phenomena do not require them to be inherently existent. They just need to meet these three criteria. And if one of them is missing, the whole lot topples over. Our second question is of. So the question is, if it is therefore accepted that forms conventionally exist, what is it that we refute about them? So I think either the Chris's, the merely imputed, or the Chris Lumley could answer this one. What is it that we're actually refuting about forms?
Yeah, that they exist inherently.
That's right, that they have. So we refute forms' inherent existence, and at the same time we accept their conventional existence. Because it does meet the criteria for a conventional existence, doesn't it? A form. We could all look at it and go, yeah, that's a form. And, you know, I would look at something like this and go, yeah, light is a form, that surface, that mirror, that's a form. Linda, what do you think? And she might go, yeah, sure, I agree. Delma, you'd look, yeah, sure. So we have the first one, consensus. Then we could ask it, somebody else might say, no, it's not, that's taste. Or that's sound. And, you know, so they're trying to go, well, hang on a minute. We ask questions and go, no, you're actually wrong, we're correct. So it was not refuted by another conventional consciousness. So we keep it. Does it inherently exist? If we examine it through logical analysis, we go, no, it's a dependent arising. So it meets the criteria. That phenomena conventionally exists. But there's an interesting statement. So it's asked, what does it mean when a text says, when analyzed, it does not exist? Linda, would you like to have a go there? Sue, are you still here, Sue? I can't see her in there.
Yeah,
okay,
I'm here,
Sue,
Eddie.
Why don't you tell me? Sue, you haven't had a go for a while.
I said it means that the phenomena lack inherent existence when subjected to ultimate analysis.
Yeah, that's it. That's great. That'll do it. So what does not exist is the inherent existence of it. It does not exist when it's analyzed using this analysis. It doesn't exist there conventionally either, but you know, you can't get at that unless you use the analysis. So anything interesting about this last little bit here on the conventionalities of phenomena?
Oh, it's always good, Linda. I always got confused with that third point. It must not be invalidated by reasoning when accurately analysing the ultimate, you know, for the three criteria.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Is it a bit clearer this time, Sue?
I think so. Mine came up with this statement and it helped, I think, and it said, this reputation does not deny their dependent conventional existence, but instead reveals their lack of intrinsic existence.
That's right.
So I put the two in together, you know, because I kept thinking it's talking about ultimate here, but we're trying to make it conventional existence. So I find that one tricky. Yeah.
So we find that it lacks, has no intrinsic existence. Its only existence it could have would be dependent, right? Which is conventional, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Not denying that. Yeah, the ultimate doesn't deny that.
No,
yeah.
That's right. The ultimate does not deny its conventional existence. It denies its inherent existence. And if it were found to be inherently existent, then the other two wouldn't stand up.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes it's the wording makes it difficult for us. Yeah, I think that's why I said to maybe it was down a little while ago. So what does that mean? It's like, oh yeah. So it's always good to come back to yourself and go, I might have the answer, but what does that mean? You know,
yeah.
So just really having answers here, it's helpful, but it should lead to another question. Like if you don't understand it, that's the next question, isn't it? What does that mean? I've got the question. I'm not really sure what the meaning of the question is. I've got the answer. I don't know what that means either. We need to ask another question. So let's do our last meditation. Again, just get comfortable. So relax the body and let it breathe itself. And just rest your mind on the breath. Now create an altruistic motivation to understand existence deeply by bridging wisdom and compassion for the benefit of all sentient beings. So here's the paradox, seeming paradox I'd like you to think about. How can things be empty yet still function? So phenomena are empty of inherent existence when analysed. And because they are empty of that inherent existence, they can function. So clinging to any upstream will obscure this truth. emptiness, the realization of emptiness, the understanding of it, it does not negate existence. It reveals interconnectedness. Like a desert mirage, appearances seem real from afar. But their reality dissolves upon closer inspection. So how can we confirm conventional realities without inherent truth? We can do this in sort of three ways: through coherence, meaning through dependence upon causes and conditions; through function, dependent upon parts; and shared experience, so language and perception, language and conception. So our conventional realities are like rainbows. They're vividly appearing, yet they're intangible at the very same time. Now, when we forget this and see phenomena as being solid and real, what happens to us? So we become overpowered by attachment, aversion, and confusion. We mistake shadows for the realities. So when it's said that those who understand emptiness have greater faith in cause and effect, we're embracing emptiness with functionality. Why do this? So you wish to embrace emptiness with the understanding of functionality or cause and effect, because it liberates us from extremes of behavior and extremes of view. Letting go of these extreme views and behaviors, then clarity and compassion can flourish. So for the rest of today, now and then, observe your own experiences to be empty of any intrinsic nature and meaningful. Empty and meaningful. Empty and consequential. And now breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale. And just let your eyes flutter open. Okay, so we've come to the end of our class for today. We looked at these 13 answers to the questions. And there are different things that we can do in relationship to what we've studied. So I've put up just a couple. It's like spot the connections. When things don't intrinsically exist, they independently exist. Therefore, they're connected in some way. The deepest way is through our own awareness and our language. And other than that, there's the parts and the causes and conditions. In terms of being a change detective, it's like notice your own moods and how they can change and flip your whole day. Your moods can change the day. The day can change your moods. There's an interrelated, they're interrelated. It gives you really good acknowledgement of your own power here. In other words, we play a part in the creative process, what we experience. So try to remain as flexible as you can and, you know, understand, I guess, or to try to bring into yourself. Remember, most people don't know what we know. And what we know, we haven't been able to actually integrate very well yet. But we do know that things don't have intrinsic nature, and most other people don't know that. And they're all going to behave as if they have the intrinsic nature they don't have. So we can expect some bad behavior from other people, right? And when we behave badly, we know we've forgotten. Right? So quickly forgive yourself, forgive the other people, and let's just keep moving on, be the best people we can be. Okay, so next week we'll finish off these last the last 10 questions of this material, which you'll get emailed to you shortly. And so it's, we put some effort into this, 10 o'clock till midday. So let's dedicate this material. So please join me in saying, and of course it's recollecting like Khyentse Rinpoche, who spent years putting this material together. I've used a lot of material from His Holiness and also Geshe Sopa. So remember the kindness of these teachers and of one another to support us in doing this class. Say, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. And in a request for the long life of His Holiness, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the swift return of the person who was, you know, once we used to call Lama Zopa Rinpoche, we remember his kindness and his compassion. So in holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged, the incomparable Venerable Guru, to make this request.